Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 14th. Today's session is entitled Creating a Conscience, Raising Ethical Children in Today's World, presented by Hallie Florine. Let's listen in.
This is all the home I have right now. But right now, I live here, and this is a day very much like today. Mm-hmm. And that's where I live. At the very top of the village, Chalet 9, upstairs. my training was primarily in child clinical psychology. And although I spent a lot of my career working with chronic pain as well, I also spent most of my time in private practice working with children and their families. A number of years ago, I started presenting workshops for continuing education for mental health professionals. And about a year and a half before coming into Holden, I was working for American Society of Professional Education and traveling with a workshop called Overindulged Children that was given for school principals, school counselors, some teachers, psychologists, social workers, and so on. And I've taken some part, that was an all-day workshop, that I ended up going many parts of the country with. And I've taken parts of that for our class today. We're checking and seeing if there's some time tomorrow to continue this because it really takes a lot of very fast talking to get most of the information in an hour. So we'll see if that can work out. Our agenda today is going to be, first of all, here in the 21st century, what are the changes that we see in the family? What's different now? Then I'm going to talk about the concept of overindulgence as I presented it in the workshops that I gave. And then I'll talk a bit about moral development. How does that happen in a child? What are the ways that we provide moral development as parents? And then I'm going to talk about seven key parenting issues. And in all probability, we won't get to all seven. But if we have time tomorrow, then I could finish up the seven key parenting issues. Any questions before I start about me or? Okay.
If you can't tomorrow, what about Saturday morning?
Yeah, that might be good as well. So there currently isn't anything scheduled tomorrow, so I think the chances are pretty good for tomorrow.
I'll just probably type them tomorrow.
Morning would be good tomorrow for us. Yeah. We'll be gone
Saturday.
Selfishly.
And selfishly, Saturday is my day off. Oh.
Playing a bummer again.
Okay. I'm going to start with a Bob Dylan song. I have a brother-in-law who is such a huge Bob Dylan fan. He feels there's a Bob Dylan song for every occasion. So this is the Bob Dylan song for this occasion. And while I'm doing this, I'm going to get my briefcase here. Come mothers and fathers throughout the land and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand, because the times, they are a-changing. And I think this was as relevant today as it was way back when he first wrote it. Just gotta get a piece of equipment here. Some notes. And, you know, times really have been changing. You know, if we were to look at 1930 and before, we were a rural country. You know, 70% of families lived in rural areas. Tiny towns that supported rural areas or on farms. And for people that were involved in farming, of course that was and is very hard work, but families worked together often. And so often the daughter was in the kitchen with mom learning how to bake and cook and clean and so forth. And the sons might be, out in the field or feeding the chickens or whatever, you know. And so there was a lot of time that the family spent together. And generally when they sat down for meals, they sat down for meals together. Now by 1950, about 70% of families had moved into urban, suburban kind of living situations. And I know this isn't as true in suburban situations, but certainly in urban situations, a lot of times people don't even know their neighbors. You know, one of the things that was nice about the early, when our country was rural, was that families often lived, cousins and aunts and uncles and grandparents. You know, there's a high percentage of grandparents that lived in the home with the family. But as we became urbanized, there got to be less and less of that. So people became widely scattered from their family and often didn't know their neighbors. And that has continued till today, where we as a country have very poor support systems for families in most cases. You know, I have this remote control phobia here because this remote control doesn't always work for me. Okay, and the slide that we skipped over was just talking about how hard parents are working these days. You know, it used to be quite a number of years ago that Japan was considered the world's most workaholic culture. Well, that's no longer true. Since 1990, Americans have added a full work week to their year. And currently, Americans work 137 hours more a year. That's 3.5 weeks of 40-hour weeks than the Japanese. Now, I don't think that's anything to be proud of, especially since in this particular study that was done by the United Nations International Labor Organization, that work hours had decreased in every other country that was surveyed, while the United States went up. Isn't that sad? And the same thing has happened with children. You know, they have now a 25% drop since 1970 in free play. You know, and part of that is because of our culture where people are fearful of letting their kids be involved in free play. But free play is the work of childhood. And you know what I'm going to do? I just realized I'm going to turn off a couple of these lights. And if you could turn that, I think we could see this better. How's that?
That's back over there.
Yeah. Yeah, if you could just turn that off. Children have lost 50% of free outdoor play. And if we can think back to our childhoods, the wonderful memories of, running out and climbing trees and making forts and, exploring and stuff, it's just not happening in most cases with kids. And there has been a 25% reduction in family vacations. So families aren't going away together as much as they used to. And that's probably because the parents are working harder. And they're working harder because they need to in our culture. And another study that I thought was really interesting was done looking at the amount of time parents actually talk with their children each day. You know, what, not what time should I pick you up, but really talking with them. And they found it ranged from 8 to 13 minutes a day. 8 minutes was how much a father typically talked with his children during the work week. Mothers talked a little bit more during the work week. Fathers talked 11 minutes a day on the weekends with their children. And stay-at-home parents were the top with 13 minutes a day, which frankly doesn't impress me very much. So, you know, a lot of times we're so stressed for time in today's culture. And often what parents will do is say, I want the time I spend with my kids to be fun. And so they become these Disneyland parents that every time they're with their kids, they're going to the movies, they're going to, you know, some sort of fun outing, which I have nothing against. But what they're losing out on is communication time, where parents are really giving their kids information about how to live their life, what is important. Another thing is that we have become a much more materialistic culture. I can't really hear my sound effects. It's sometimes been called the hyper-Americanized family, that many American families are all about image. You know, how many square feet in your house, how many image cars in the driveway, how many toys does the family have? You know, all of these kinds of things. And often you hear of parents saying, I work two jobs just to get my family what they need. And what ends up happening is that wants become misinterpreted as needs. We that live here at Holden learn how little you really need to live. And we still have a lot of, you know, special, we have a lot of special things that they wouldn't have had 100 years ago. But we find, for example, when kids come here, often the kids are brought here kicking and screaming, you know, no TV, no video games, what am I gonna do? I'm gonna be so bored. And by the end of a week here, they are having a fabulous time because they realize there's many better things to do than sit in front of the boob tube. I got to tell you a cute story about this teacher that was in at the audience in the workshop, and she raised her hand, so she had an example that she was a primary school teacher, and she only... she taught, had a little section where she tried to teach children the difference between wants and needs, which I think is a very wonderful thing that she's doing. So one little girl really thought she got it, so she's waving her hand and says, teacher, teacher, and she said, I have an example. A television is a need. A remote control is a want. Becoming a nation of couch potatoes. They estimated, and let me grab for this statistic, that the average school-age child spends 35 hours a week in front of a TV screen. That's almost a full-time job. You know, isn't that awful?
GPS work?
No, just kidding.
We could pay them for it. My own feeling is that kids are getting less creative because they don't have free play, because they look, even their toys have become canned. you know, there's certain ways to play with their toys rather than often the creative ways that that we might have played. So let's talk about overindulgence, what it is. And you know, most people think of overindulgence as spoiling a child. Well, there's a psychologist named David Bredehoft, who is at Concordia University in St. Paul. It seems like all the researchers into overindulgence are in Minnesota. Isn't that interesting?
That sounds so interesting.
I don't know what that says, but I have some ideas. Anyway, David Bredehoft, who is probably the best known researcher on overindulgence, defines overindulgence in three categories. First is too much stuff. You know, kids in general have too much. You know, on Christmas morning, have you ever been at a Christmas like that where the kids go through all their packages a zillion miles an hour and says, is that it? You know, it's just really kind of sad. And that too much stuff doesn't only mean materialism, it also means activities. You know, really spending and doing too much just for fun rather than the parent as a teacher. Teachers tell me that often parents will come in and say, you know, when the teacher suggests they do something at home with the child, they'll say, you're the teacher, that's your job. Mm-hmm. You know. Second is over-nurturing, or what's been called smother love. And that's too much assistance that ends up in over-reliance on parents. You know, I bet some of you have been to a science fair, and you've seen, you know, this intricate project that you look at and you think, only an engineer could have done this. And then you see this father talking animatedly about the project, you know. And incidentally, he is an engineer. And there's the kid looking bored because he did very little of it. You know, that's what we call over-nurturing. And I think by over-nurturing, we are teaching a lot of kids not to be self-reliant. In fact, some college professors told me that the kids come into college requiring much more help. Often parents will be filling out their applications, coming with them to register. I mean, and I heard of this one college, I know it's related to some research, but said they're no longer going to have 7 a.m. classes because they want the college students to get enough sleep. As if college students weren't mature enough to decide what was enough sleep. And last is soft structure. And I think this is important because this can happen even in homes where there isn't much money. In fact, some kids are neglected and overindulged because they have no structure. You know, the parents, I call it fly by the seat of your pants parenting. And I think we've all done a lot of that. I have. And I just want to mention, I'm not putting myself forward as an awesome parent because I made just as many mistakes as everybody else. But lax rules. There's no clear-cut rules in the family. The children have no chores, and that's an important one. And that they're, you know, it's just kind of an aimless way of life. And so these are the three main points of overindulgence. And this is my favorite cartoon about this. Please go back to your seat, Mrs. Campbell. You don't see any of the other parents blocking for their kids, do you? And you know, with how crazy some parents get about sports, that this might have happened, actually. And for those of you that are interested in books, I printed off a little book list, but My favorite book on overindulgence is by Bretta Hoft and two other Minnesotans, Jean Isley Clark and Ilsley Clark and Connie Dawson. And it just really is a nice, good-humored way of talking about overindulgence and really covers a lot of what we're talking about. There's also studies of what they call of overindulgence that you can access at a website, overindulgence.info, that looks at what happens to kids that are overindulged as children. And they're known as ACOs. Any of you that are familiar with AA terminology, there's ACAs and there's NAs and all, well, this is a new set of initials, adult children of overindulgence. And they found that through interviewing people and having some criteria for determining if they were overindulged in children, they found that these adults had a number of characteristics. One is having difficulty learning how to delay gratification. I want it now, you know. Trouble giving up status as a constant center of attention. You know, you've all seen parents where the kid is really running the show. Have you seen that? And just difficulty with competency. They haven't learned ordinary, everyday skills to be, especially self-care and relating to others. They really haven't learned how to be generous or empathic. They have trouble taking responsibility. It's always somebody else's fault. You know, if the teacher wouldn't have done this, I wouldn't have flunked the test. There's a lot of that. And then difficulty establishing a personal identity, trouble knowing what is enough. What is enough spending? What is enough eating? What is enough exercising? What is enough, you know, recreation? Very, and this is probably the most important one, trouble knowing what is normal. You know, many overindulged children as they grow up think always that, you know, if something goes wrong for them, it's really, really awful. And for other people, that should be okay. You know, they don't really know what is normal to expect out of life because they've been overindulged. Now, I just want to run through some more psychologically based parenting tasks that I think are important. First is attachment and intimacy. Second is emotional regulation and self-control. Third is moral development, which we'll spend most of the time on. And four is problem solving and decision making. You know, attachment is a huge topic in psychology today. I mean, there's weekend long workshops on attachment and attachment disorders, so I'm not going to go into that. But basically, you know, parents need to make a connection with their child. And the way they make their connection, how do you think they make their connection?
Holding the child?
Yeah, that's one part of it. Any other parts of it?
Feeding, caring for it.
Yeah, having that kind of intimacy. What about talking to the child?
Same.
And probably the most important thing of all is eye contact. They've discovered in the brain something that are called mirror neurons that give scientists the idea that kids come knowing what expressions mean. And what the kid does is learn how to mirror their parents' expressions. And by doing that, it lays the groundwork for empathy. Now, for a lot of kids that are neglected or have multiple caregivers, they never make a good connection, and they become what we call attachment disorders, and they lack empathy. And I don't know if you've had this situation, but as a therapist I have, of looking into a kid's eyes and just having emptiness coming back. You know they could stomp all over you and not feel a thing. You know, they just don't connect. Now don't panic. We're only going to talk about a couple parts of the brain, but just for fun, I want you to make a brain with me, okay? What you need to do is put your hand up like this, fold your thumb over like this, and then curl your fingers like that, okay? This is a remarkably accurate model of a brain. Okay, now that you've had the, you know, the tactile experience, I'll explain. If your arm is your neck, the spinal cord runs up there, and here in the heart of your brain is what's called the brain stem, which is also been called the reptilian brain because it's what's necessary for basic life functions. I understand I could be wrong, but when a reptile is born, it's fully functional. And so it has everything to sustain life. And then the thumb that you folded like this has been called the limbic system or the mammalian brain. You know, with mammals, their children, infants, are not born fully formed. So it's a good idea that they remember them from day to day, right? And second, that they have some sort of emotion about their kids. And third, they have some motivation to take care of them. So the limbic system is all about long-term memory, emotion, and motivation. And then this last part is the cerebral cortex, or the newest part of the brain. And I'm not going to talk about all the parts of the cerebral cortex, but if you think of from this knuckle down to the end as the frontal cortex, then from the last knuckle down is what's called the prefrontal cortex. And you can see that up here, prefrontal cortex. And this is the part of the brain where we do our reasoning, where we make decisions, where we're logical. And they have found, interestingly enough, that in some criminal populations, their prefrontal cortex is underdeveloped. Hmm. Now, I want to talk about two parts of the limbic system. The first is the amygdala, this little almond-shaped structure. Recent research has shown that it is connected with processing emotions. It's particularly negative emotions like anger, frustration, anxiety, fear. These are a part of the amygdala processes these and sends them to everywhere in the brain, makes connections. And the third part I want to mention is the hippocampus, which some people think is shaped like a seahorse, but I don't see it myself. But the hippocampus is the base of our long-term memory. And so the amygdala and the hippocampus, emotion and long-term memory, are what are really critical in forming a conscience. Okay? That's why I'm telling you about that. I'm going to skip this one. It's not that. Okay. Now, one thing that you need to know is that the prefrontal cortex isn't fully developed till we're about 25 years old, which tells us a lot about teenagers. And that raging hormones. But what seems to happen in parenting and life experience in general is that this limbic system, there become more and more connections with the prefrontal cortex. So a kid gets angry, and the parent says, okay, I want you to take slow breaths and slow yourself down, and then we'll talk about it. That's making a connection between the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex. It's teaching them a skill, a logical skill for handling emotions. Now, there's a lot of parents that say, my child has a right to express his emotions, which means it's okay for him to have a tantrum. In other words, the parent doesn't emphasize teaching connections. And so the child is born developed not having as significant connections, and they have out of control tempers a lot of times. And so, you know, this is the impulsive approach. Do whatever you feel like. Do your own thing. And this is a considered approach. And where kids get that from is parenting, of course. You know, primarily, other places as well. It's cold in here, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That just said what I already said. Okay. If the way I think of conscience is, I think of conscience is strong memories flavored by emotion that cause us to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And it's provided by all the important people in a child's life. And so let's look at how this works. First of all, talking a bit about memory. One of the things we've learned is we have memory all over our body. Every time neurons connect to other neurons, we are developing more memory. But there's two basic types of memory. The first is called the amygdala system, or sometimes called implicit memory, or emotional sensory memory. And then there is what's called the hippocampal-based memory, which is more factual and autobiographical and doesn't involve emotion, okay? Now, almost every memory is made up of a combination of those two things. But the thing that's important to know is the amygdala system is present from birth. We have memories, but they're completely emotional and sensory. There's no sense of time or anything, okay? So there's some infants, some adults will have flashes that are infant memory. Has anybody ever had that? It's usually a traumatic memory when they've had that. I remember someone telling me that they had been in a ventilator or something as a child, and remembers looking up at parents through, you know, apparatus, just has a flash of that vision. But the hippocampal system doesn't start developing until a child is around 18 months old. So that's, you know, when kids start usually having memories, is about 18 months old. Conscious time-related memories. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, why am I telling you this? Implicit memories, emotional, sensory memories, make explicit memories stronger. So let's say a two-year-old starts running into the street. If the mom says, honey, you know you shouldn't be running into the street, that's not going to make much impact on a two-year-old. Probably what you do is say, stop! Never run in the street, because you want to get that kid's attention. Like, clap your hands, you know, something that's going to get that kid's emotional memory going. One person that attended one of my workshops had been taken driver's ed in high school. You know, he was a middle-aged person now, but and he was, when he was out driving with his instructor, he came to a yield sign and he just sort of blithely drove through it. And just as he was doing that, the instructor went like that right in his ear and said loudly, "Never drive through a yield sign without slowing down." And he says, to this day, he sees a yield sign, he hears that clap in the visitors, because it made a smart teacher, huh? Mm-hmm. And so often the most important learnings we have are connected to strong emotion. You know, if we hurt a best friend's feelings and we just, you know, see how unhappy they are and that makes us feel bad, that becomes a strong conscience memory. You know, if you're mean to friends, you're gonna feel bad. And there's a psychiatrist, child psychiatrist at Berkeley, that wrote a book called The Epidemic, which is quite an interesting book, related to overindulgence and what kids are experiencing today. But he talks about critical moments, and he says they're key learning experiences that lay the groundwork for appropriate and moral behavior, and they're most powerful when associated with emotion. Okay. Now, one of the problems is a lot of parents don't want their kids ever to have negative emotions. You know, so they protect them from them. Now, sweetie, you need to be nice to Harry, you know, without having there being any emotional tone to it. Let me give you an example of a critical moment. A mom has taken her 4-year-old to the grocery store, and as they're shopping, the 4-year-old spies the candy section and says, "I want a candy bar." And the mom says, "You know, we're going home, we're going to have lunch, I don't want you to spoil your appetite." So the little kid raises the volume a little bit, and the mom says, "No, absolutely not, you're not having a candy bar." And the kid starts kind of whining loudly. Mom holds her ground. Then the kid starts screaming. Mom holds her ground. Pretty soon the kid is on the ground, kicking, screaming, full-blown tantrum. This is what we call a critical moment. Whatever the parent teaches at that moment is going to be very, very well remembered. So if the mother is really embarrassed and says, "Shh, shh, shh, okay, just this once," what has the child learned?
Scream for what you want.
Scream for what you want. And don't we all see kids all the time that do that? You know, especially in shopping malls. But what if the parent says, "You know, we're out of here. Yeah. We're leaving, and we're going to go and sit in the car until you can decide you're mature enough to go in there." Now, if the kid wants to leave, that's probably not a good strategy. But you see what I mean. Yeah. You know, that's very important. And another attendee told me the story of when she was growing up in a very small town. There was across from the school, there was this little store where kids could get soda and snacks and stuff. And often kids will see what they could get away with in stealing. But the owner of the store had a policy that if he caught any kids stealing, what they had to do is sweep out in front of the store and, you know, hose down the sidewalk. And everybody driving by, because he'd owned that store many years, would know if a kid was out there sweeping that he'd stolen from the store. So it was kind of public shaming in a sense, besides, you know, doing a job. And she got talked into by her friends, she says, trying it. And she got caught. And she said, "I will never forget the humiliation of sweeping that sidewalk. She says, and we were in a hotel conference room and where they give out pens. She said, I'm not even going to take this pen because I'm afraid it might be stealing. That's how strong it is, you know? So, steps of conscience development, experience strong sensation or emotion, the parent supplies a good cognition, and this together creates internal guidance, and these strong learnings become the conscience. Now, it doesn't only come from parents, of course, teachers, later on peers, you know, a lot of people, neighbors, provide conscience development. But what we're seeing is that overindulgent children are not developing a strong conscience. They feel entitled. They don't feel the rules apply to them. And I can't even begin to tell you the horror stories I've heard from teachers about entitlement of kids. You know, some of you may have heard, this was about 7, 8 years ago, I think, of a teacher in Kansas who, her high school class, she assigned them a report and said that this would comprise the greater part of their grade for that quarter. And if they plagiarized this report, it would be not only an automatic failure for the paper, but also for the course. Well, there's an internet site called turnitin.com. Has anybody heard of that? Well, it's been developed so that teachers can check if things have been plagiarized. And the really clever thing about it is that every time a paper is entered into the system, it becomes part of the database. So these two kids in LA one time from different school districts thought, oh, you know, we'll exchange, you know, we'll use each other's papers. And they were caught because of that. Well, she did this, this Kansas teacher did this, and found that 80% of the kids had plagiarized the paper. So she gave those 80% failing grades. And the parents were thrilled. They said, what a wonderful, no, I'm lying. School board and demanded her to be fired, that she be fired. Well, first they went to the principal. The principal supported the teacher. The school board didn't. And they instead said that those kids couldn't go to prom.
That was the
plan. And the teacher was, from what I understand, was fired, then reinstated, and then she resigned. But isn't that awful?
No.
I mean, what I often will tell parents is, think, what am I teaching my child now? You know, my child will have learned that I get them out of scrapes when they're caught driving drunk.
Yeah.
When they, you know, when they're picked up for shoplifting. You know, their parents will bail them out and say, I don't want them to have a police record. Well, what are they teaching them? It's just kind of astounding. Let's see, I want to make sure.
It's 11:30.
It's 11:30. Good. Okay. And what are the reasons overindulging parents do this? First of all, often they're too busy. And it's just a fact of life. I mean, it's hard to live in the United States today. And I have a lot of sympathy for parents because they work so hard. But unless kids are made a priority, often the parents just don't spend enough time with their kids. Second, they have the belief they don't want the children to experience painful emotions. You know, it's hard for a lot of parents to understand that in order for a child to develop into an ethical adult, they need to experience some pain. But there's a lot of parents that go through many hoops so child doesn't experience any discomfort. I think it all came along in the 70s with the self-esteem movement, you know, where people felt, you know, that you always had to tell a child that you loved everything they did, and that was going to give them good self-esteem. What in fact it does is teach the kid that their parents don't know anything. Kid scribbles something, and unless they're 1.5, the parents say, "Oh, that's so beautiful!" You know, that, what is the child learning, you know, in that kind of a situation? Okay. So, I just want to go through some of the issues and then we'll continue it tomorrow, okay? I'm going to go through 7. Too little parenting time, lack of a clear belief system and values, lack of structure and consequences, too much help, too much stuff, focus on constant happiness, and too much focus on self-esteem. And I believe in self-esteem. I believe it's good, but I don't think it comes from compliments. And we'll talk more about that later. So that gives you an overview. You know, I was a single parent almost from the time my son was 3 months old until he left home. And I used to love this saying, it's not the quantity of time you spend with your child, but the quality. Because I didn't have much time. I had to work full time and so forth. But that's not really true, is it? I mean, it's true, the quality should be there, but the quantity needs to be there as well. It just doesn't work if we don't have quantity. And I like this quote too. Families are overscheduled outside the home and underscheduled within the home. I think a good place to start in a family is to schedule in the family first. Okay, every night we have dinner together. That doesn't matter, you know, we schedule around it. We just don't miss dinner. And we turn off the phone and we turn off the TV. And that's our time to check in with each other. And I just have some quick things that I've thought of or heard about. The first is lower your standard of living. I always joke that I've been downwardly mobile for years, which is true. I mean, I live at home, so I'm sort of at the lowest point of earnings that I've had. But, you know, I found as I've gone from a house to a townhouse to an apartment to a room, that there isn't any difference in my happiness level. There's not any difference in, I don't feel deprived or anything. And often parents who have this huge house and these multiple cars and all these toys realize they're spending all their time maintaining all of that. And if they get rid of a lot of that, they will end up having more time. The other thing is to go from a job that isn't horribly stressful so you can make the big bucks. But go to a job that's less stressful, you make less money, but you have more time with your kids. Mm-hmm. And I've usually asked as I traveled the country if anybody had done that. And I've heard some wonderful stories. One time a family became caretakers of a large estate and made nothing. I mean hardly anything. But they remember it as the happiest years. Their kids do. You know, as they had all this family time and they could roam the grounds, that was an added bonus. But, and, you know, kids are so overscheduled these days. You know, they have soccer, they have piano lessons, they have Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts, and the parents are hauling them to 10 different things. I think that reducing outside activities to maybe two or three at most is a better idea. First of all, it also gives kids a time to really get good at something rather than having tried something and quit it. I don't know how many times, you know, I've talked to young adults that say, oh, I tried piano and I tried the trumpet and I tried, you know, this. But they can play none of them because they've not stuck to anything. This is especially good for teenagers, using drive time to talk, because teenagers, they don't have to look at you. And that's a big bonus with teenagers. They'll say things in a car that they won't normally say other places. And so one of my favorite stories about my son when he was little was, he must have been about 8, I guess. And we were going for a car trip. And after we'd gone a little ways, he turned to me and said, Mom, let's have a wide-ranging conversation. I love that because, you know, that's exactly what he meant, where we just talk about whatever we think about. And what a gift that is, you know, to be able to do that. Family night. How many people have had family night in their homes? Yeah. You know, where it's hard to do here at Holden because we have community night almost every night. But family night is a nice thing to have, where you get together and play games or just talk. Just a time where the family is all together. One woman told me that every Friday night they had pizza as a family. And one Friday a month they could invite a friend to come to. And pizza at the Paulsons became renowned. People being invited over for pizza at the Paulsons. Also having one-on-one dates. You know, let's say you have three kids. Let's say Sunday afternoon, mom takes one kid, dad takes the other kid, the third kid plays at the neighbors, and then the next week it all switches. So that 2 out of 3 weeks, the child has some one-to-one time with the parent. And that doesn't mean going to the movies, it means doing something where you can talk. Putting all of this stuff in a family room rather than bedrooms. You know, kids spend so much time in their own room, and most kids have their own television, their own computer, their own video games. Limit TV. And then the last one is make family dinner mandatory. And I'm going to just tell you about a research study that was done. They found that only 25% of families eat dinner together. In a University of Michigan study, time eating as a family was a far stronger factor in young children's academic success and psychological well-being than time spent in school, doing homework, participating in sports, arts, and religious activities. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a great place for families to start. Would people like to continue for a couple more minutes, and then stop, mm-hmm. and we'll go through. Lack of a clear belief system. You know, my dearest wish, which will never come true, is that parents be required to take parenting classes before they have children. You know, I mean, you need a fishing license. Mm-hmm. You know, shouldn't you need a parenting license? I really feel that it's never going to happen. But so many parents have children and have never thought how they're going to raise their children. What are their beliefs? And so if there was a class, you know, where they could discuss, what are my values? What is it I'd like to communicate to my child? What's most important to me? I think that would really be valuable. Now, I had a little edge because I went to graduate school in psychology, in child clinical psychology, and so, of course, I thought about those things a lot, but I still made as much mistakes as anyone, I guess. But I think that parents should have thought through what is their belief system, and then not just act it out, although that's important, but also talk about it. You know, we brought soup over to our next door neighbor who's ill. How did that feel? And the kid might say, I felt good about it. Yeah, you know, helping others really feels good. And that kind of discussion. And, you know, sometimes parents would ask me, if my kids are already teenagers, should I just throw in the towel? And one thing I learned from a psychiatrist, child psychiatrist, I worked in my first job, he said, there are no mistakes that you can't fix later. You know, and I don't think that's entirely true, but I think it's possible for parents to admit their mistakes to their kids and say, now is a new beginning. You know, it used to be when you said jump, I'd say how high. But I realize I've been unfair to you, that this is not a good thing. And so we're setting down some ground rules. We're going to take a weekend and we're going to have a family conference and set up a list of family values and then how we're going to act on them. And that can happen any time in a family's life. You know, I like to mention this because I did it and I think most of us have done it. And that's where we think back on how we were parented and say, boy, I'm never going to do that. And I think a little of that is fine. But I think some parents that have been, for example, raised by very rigid parents may become too lazy to fare. And then you are parenting according to your childhood rather than according to the child you have. And so often if people have had really tough childhoods, then it's better to, you know, speak to a minister or a counselor about it and get that, you know, out of your own system and come to some peace with it rather than saying, okay, I'm never going to scream at my child or raise my voice because my mother was an out-of-control screamer. Well, you know, you may need to raise your voice sometimes. I'm not for screaming, but, you know, I think it's better to resolve past issues that way. And this we'll spend a little time about, but I think that there needs to be structure, you know, in not only in a child's environment, but also in their minds. Mm-hmm. You know, what you teach a child is going to structure their mind. And if there is no structure, it's going to make it harder for them. And so it's good to have consequences in place for kids and have talked it through beforehand rather than after. Now, sometimes you can't help it, but mm-hmm. still. You know, permissive parenting. If you want to see a great movie or if any of you work with teenagers to have it as a discussion point, there's a movie called Mean Girls. Has anybody seen that? It's about bullying behavior in girls, which is a little different from bullying behavior. But there is the best example of a permissive parent in there that is just hysterical. I mean, you know, she dresses like her daughter, and she says, I'm not like a real parent. I'm like a fun parent. You know, that kind of thing. Where, you know, there's just no structure whatsoever. And when I was in graduate school, it was in the 70s. And I remember, you know, there was some belief, I didn't go to that kind of school, but there was the belief at that time that children were like these beautiful buds, that if you just let them be, kept them nourished, they would open into beautiful roses. Of course, you know, you read Lord of the Flies, and you get a different picture. You know, you know, good children require some kind of structure and limits. Another is giving away parental power. You know, I've seen parents where they're sitting discussing things with their children and trying to convince their child to do something. Like, now, mommy and daddy haven't been able to go out to dinner for a long time. It would be okay, wouldn't it, if we had Susie next door over? I mean, who's in charge? You know, the child is running the show. And then negotiating. You know, I believe negotiating is a good skill to teach a child, but you need to teach it at the level that they're able to deal with it. You know, if they're 4 or 5 years old, you're going to give them 2 choices, both of which you can live with. and then, gradually, as they demonstrate their ability to make good decisions, they're, you know, going to be able to make more and more choices. That's when it's okay to negotiate, when a child has learned about making good decisions. Then negotiation is fine. But parents that are always negotiating with their kids, especially when they negotiate around things that they don't want, you know. But mom, all of the kids are going to this sleepover, and it'll be fine. The parents will be around, you know, and, you know, nothing will happen, even if there's mixed boys and girls, you know. And the parents saying, well, you know, and making that open for discussion. Now, I'm giving a personal view right now, and you may not have the same personal view, but I personally would not send a child of mine to a mixed sleepover. But many parents do. Mm-hmm. And this probably is the worst thing, is protecting from consequences. I think, you know, when a baby and a toddler, you protect them. You know, you don't say, I'm going to let my infant stick her finger into the, you know, into the electrical outlet just to understand what happens. You know, you're going to protect that child completely. But the older child gets, the less protection you want to offer. Until by the time a child is 16 and 17, if they're caught stealing a car, they need to deal with the consequences. And you don't spend, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on a pricey attorney to get them off. In fact, there's this one kid that his parents had, he was a really cocky kid, and he dominated his parents through much of his growing up. And so one day they noticed he was wearing a pair of very expensive athletic shoes, And they asked him where they came from, and he very in a very cocky way said, "I took them." You know? And so so the parents did what you know is the right thing to do, which is say, "You're going back to that store and return those shoes and apologize and ask what you need to do," and you know. But then they said, once he did that, they said, "We want you to earn the value of those shoes. So for the next month, you're going to be doing extra chores, and we're going to have a dollar value attached to them, and until you've earned the value of these shoes." And he did. And then they took the money, went to the shoe store, bought the shoes, then went to a homeless shelter and dropped them off. And I thought, what a wonderful set of learnings for this kid. The parents had really thought it through. The consequences made sense. You know, and that's one thing I want to emphasize before we stop, is it's best if the consequences make sense. You know, if a kid comes home after school and has peanut butter and jelly and makes a big mess on the counter, you can give the kid a timeout. Or you can say, you know, this mess is really disgusting to clean up. So for the next 3 days, you're going to clean everybody else's messes and learn how it feels to be left with a mess. That's a consequence that makes sense, teaches something. Okay? So why don't we stop for today and continue tomorrow.
Thank you. Do you have a list of the books you've been talking about?
Yes.
Those of us
who have five of them.
Oh.
But I could make more for tomorrow.
I don't need a list. There's something in that book you had in the very first couple of slides.
Well, I'll give it to you because so that you could copy it and then give it to somebody else.
Oh, how much is in that?
Yeah.
How much?
You'd like?
Just one.
Just one.
Yeah.
I thought you said two.
No.
Okay. They used to have the first one in the bookstore. Yeah, I think they still do. But we can order it. Might be good if
somebody else wanted
one. Oh, my notes. More data. Didn't you want my data?
Thanks for coming.
Could you get tomorrow for two pictures of grandparents? The only great thing is that some of these things are fun. But we are actually also helping our parents. And so that's a good thing.
And I've talked about that a lot. So
oh, wait, can you address that tomorrow?
I sure will.
Grandparents.
I sure will. Yeah, and in this section would be a good time to do it.
Okay, great.